Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And today on Bookmark, our studio guest is Peter Adamson. He'll be talking about his political thriller, The Kennedy Moment. We'll also hear from writer and broadcaster Simon Mayo on his first novel for adults, Mad Blood Rising. And we'll listen to two winning entries from the Rock Road Library Creative Writing Competition. But we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, Peter. But welcome to Bookmark. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Lee.
And we're talking to young writers. Well, we're listening to the young writers from the Rock Road Library Writing Competition later in the show. Did you always want to be a writer?
Yes, although very early in my career, I got diverted into working in a different area. I started the New Internationalist magazine.
Not that different then. It's still sort of writing and publishing, isn't it?
I've always earned my living and with my, not pen but keyboard, but in many different formats. But the idea of writing fiction was always there in the back of my mind, yes.
Establishing a magazine, that's quite a step.
Well, that was back in the 1970. And it was a monthly magazine about world poverty and world development. And everyone said at the time it didn't have a chance of survival. So I'm really very proud and very surprised to be able to say that it's still going, you know, nearer 50 years later. So that was, that's not down to me. That's due to some wonderful people who have carried on the magazine since. But it's still something that pleases me a great deal.
And this area is obviously a keen area of interest for you. It crops up in your novel. And you worked for 16 years as senior advisor to the executive director of UNICEF in New York.
Yes, I was always self-employed. So I'm never a staff member, but I was in New York an awful lot during those 16 years. And I think that pretty much shows in a book too, which largely set in New York of the 1980s.
Well, let's, as I said, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but let's listen to your first choice of music now, which is a sonata for cello and piano by Brahms. Why this one?
I guess just it's the piece of music that I've had mostly on in the background when I've been writing. It's one of the few pieces of music that I do have on in the background.
That's the Sonata for Cello and Piano by Brahms, the first choice of music from our studio guest today on Bookmark, Peter Adamson. Peter's first two novels, Facing Out to Sea and The Tuscan Master, were published in 1998 and 2001, respectively. His short story, Sahil, was awarded the Royal Society of Literature V.S. Pritchett Memorial Prize in 2013. His third novel, The Kennedy Moment, was published earlier this year. Margaret Forster said of it, "It's the most consistently intelligent and fascinating novel I've read in a long time, mesmeric." And the Literary Review said, "In lucid, persuasive prose, Peter Adamson tells a truly gripping story about something profoundly important and relevant." Lovely reviews, Peter, to have there. You must have been very pleased with those. Mm-hmm. And 17 years between publication of The Tuscan Master and this. That's quite a big gap. Why so long?
Other things intervening that I wouldn't say seem more important, but I had a lot of other work to do, people asking me to undertake writing and publishing contracts. And, it's hard sometimes to justify the tremendous amount of time and being on your own and the concentration involved in writing a novel when no one's asking you to do it. No one's paying you to do it. No one wants you to do it. You don't even know if anyone's going to read it. Therefore, it's quite hard to justify taking out a lot of time from things that people do want you to do and which do persuade you are important and which help you to earn a living. I mean, that puts it a bit negatively. I was very involved in many other aspects of work which fascinated me as well, mainly to do with international development issues.
Well, I'm glad you did take the time out to write this book. I very much enjoyed it. It's a real page-turner. For people who haven't read the book, can you tell them what it's about?
It's a difficult book to talk about, Lee, without giving
indeed.
It away.
Well, I was going to, that's why I'm leaving it to you before I spill the beans or give any spoilers.
But what I could say is that it starts with an innocent weekend reunion of old college friends who come together after 20 years in Oxford, the city of their youth. They're five people from five different countries and five different professions. They're all midlife, mid-career, professional people, reasonably conventional. And the reunion not only brings them together in a way that revives old relationships and old loves, but also gradually moves towards involvement in an extraordinary conspiracy that none of them could have envisaged in advance. And it continues in another reunion a few months later in New York, where the conspiracy they embark upon is developed and they finally, astonishingly, commit to it. And these five reasonably conventional people suddenly find themselves in the middle of a very big drama. Running alongside this is a kind of very gentle love story, because the prime mover of the plot and the conspiracy of the Kennedy moment, Dr. Michael Lowell, was, when he was a postgraduate, a Rhodes Scholar in Oxford, very much in love with a young woman from Karachi in Pakistan, Seema Mir, who was another of the main characters in the book. She at the time rejected him after going out with him for a year because, in her words, which unfortunately came back to him, she found him just a little bit too dull. He was someone who would never do anything that could surprise her. 20 years later, she has a different attitude. Astonishingly, Michael has always been in love with her all of this time. But as they come together at this reunion, Seema knows that she couldn't possibly forgive herself if she were to hurt Michael Lowell again. And so she is deliberately quite cool towards him, even though that's not what she feels inside. Michael, of course, interprets this as her not being interested. And there is a great threat that they will all live miserably ever after.
But I love the conspiracy and the momentum of that and the shockingness of that and the love story between them, because the awkwardness between them at this age, when they're in their 30s and 40s, is very similar to the awkwardness that they had when they were teenagers. And there's something, as a reader, that's very encouraging about that. We change and yet we don't.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Michael in particular, it falls into, I don't know whether it's a category, but he's an epidemiologist. He's a senior figure at the World Health Organization with quite a stellar career. And on his home ground, he is very forceful and articulate. But get him talking or thinking about relationships or talking about personal matters, and he's just the opposite. So I guess we have all known people like that.
And of course, this idea of people coming together, reunions, it's cinematically, it reminded me of The Big Chill, something like that, or even Peter's Friends. It's a good area for drama, isn't it? Because it allows people to reflect about the past and look at where they are in the present.
Exactly, yes. And the ostensible reason for the reunion, which is in fact summoned by the one member of the group who remained in Oxford and became an academic, is to examine their lives and see what became, you know, what's happened to them between this gilded youth and this possibly more tarnished middle age, and to examine what's become of them all, how their ideas and ideals and attitudes have changed and why over the time. So it's a very kind of contrived, conventional agenda, which the others are quite rebellious about. But nonetheless, I hope it gets the novel off to a good start.
It does. I mean, I'm going to tread carefully when we talk about the book, because you say you don't want to give too much away. But can you tell us, can you explain the title, The Kennedy Moment, which just might give listeners a little bit more of a clue of what's going on?
The title has misled some people into thinking that it might be about John F. Kennedy. Now, this is quite delicate, because the Kennedy Moment is the heart of the book. It refers to a speech that is given by the President of the United States, in which he, quite out of character for this particular president, finds echoes of the great speeches of John F. Kennedy, particularly the inaugural and the announcement of the commitment to go to the moon. So because it contains very conscious and specific echoes, both linguistic echoes, rhythmic echoes, of well-known Kennedy speeches, it becomes known as his Kennedy Moment.
Right, let's leave it. It's very well put your footing around it. It is quite difficult. I described it as a political thriller at the beginning. Would you go with that description? I mean, that's the description in the press release. I'm not sure I would go with that. There are elements of politics about it, but it seems to me it's as much about human nature as it is about politics.
Yes, I have a trouble myself thinking what category it might call into, because in one sense, in a vague sense, it could be called a crime novel, though not really of that genre at all. It is clearly political in one sense, but it's mostly about those five characters and their commitment to the conspiracy they embark upon. And it's a very unusual conspiracy that won't fit a category. So it is a difficult book. And I think because it tries to go into their motivations, both ostensible and real, that I hope it does have a literary quality as well. Although having said that, one of the prime motivations for the book was the challenge that I wanted to write a page turner. I really wanted to see him in my... I don't think my first two books were page turners. They were very much more in the literary genre. But I don't really like the division. I don't see why a thriller or a really good page turning story can't also be good literature. It seems a completely silly distinction to me. So I do hope it has the literary element to it, but I really set out to tell a good story.
It is a page turn. It's definitely a page turn. One of the central characters is Helene. She works in developing countries, and she's witnessed a lot of poverty and death. This does play a crucial part in the role. This is obviously something that was important to you in your career when you worked at UNICEF. This is a truth that you wanted to convey to the reader.
Well, that is definitely based not only on my own work, but on the work of many friends and colleagues over the years who've been in situations in, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa and in South Asia, of struggling with issues of extreme poverty and what it means and what can be done and why it isn't done. Those have been preoccupations for a long time, you know, myself and many colleagues who've contributed ideas and work to this, yeah.
And there's lots of figures and statistics in the book. I mean, it's quite educational. I mean that with education in a good, entertaining way, not a boring way. So it was obviously something that you wanted to get across to the reader.
Well, that's true. But also, I tried to make it very much in keeping with the character of the prime mover in the plot, Dr. Michael Lowell, because he is someone who relies a lot on statistics. He's quite nerdy. You know, he's got a fantastic head for figures. I don't think any statistics come from anybody else of any one of the other group of the group of five, but yeah, he's the channel, because that's really what he's focused on.
He's nerdy, but he's rather lovely as well. I must admit, falling a little bit in love with Dr. Michael.
Good.
Well, as we're talking about truth and basing fiction on truth, let's hear from Simon Mayo. Simon has worked on BBC Radio since 1982. His first novel for young adults, Itch, was published in 2012. It was followed by two more in the same series, Itchcraft and Itch Rocks, and a standalone, Blame, in 2016. Mad Blood Stirring is his first novel for adults. Lee Child described it as told with style, pace, character, texture and tension. And John Boyne said it was a joy to read. I met Simon when he came to Toppin's Bookshop in Ely and asked him whether it was always inevitable he would write a book for adults.
No, I don't think so. I've stumbled into everything. I haven't really planned it at all. And I just went where the story led me, really, which sounds a little bit corny. But when I found the story, the true story behind Mad Blood Stirring, I thought, I knew I needed to write the story. I wasn't sure whether it was going to be a young adult book or a fully grown-up adult book, and it just became more adult as we went through. It just felt as though the adult characters were stronger, and it just felt that it led in an adult direction. But it's a very kind of artificial divide which is being constructed for bookshops and readers, you know, to help them out. But it's a story about two teenagers, if indeed teenagers really existed in 1814, 1815, because really you were either a boy or a man, or you're a girl or you're a woman. And these guys in my book had been killing each other for the last 2 years, and an extraordinary man in his late 20s. So I don't think it was inevitable, but it's just where the story took me.
And it's based on true events. How much of it is true?
Well, the spine, the guts of the story are true. That is that in 1814, Dartmoor Prison was built for the prisoners of the Napoleonic War, but in 1814 it filled up with Americans. We were fighting a war with America, another war with America, and it had 7,000 American sailors in, and 1,000 of them were black and 6,000 were white. At the request, this is all the true stuff, at the request of the white American sailors, the prisons were segregated. And this makes it Britain's only ever racially segregated prison. There's seven blocks in Dartmoor Prison, and the non-white block was block four, and that became run by one guy in particular. And this is, again, I just remind you, listen, this is all the true stuff. He was 6'7". He was the tallest, strongest prisoner in the whole of Dartmoor. He called himself King Dick. He went everywhere with a club in one hand and a bearskin hat on his head. He was a gangster. He ran all the gambling in the prison, but he was also a theatrical impresario. And, you know, again, this is all true. And in 1814, he put on a production of Othello, and he put on a production of Romeo and Juliet. And that was the point when I thought, OK, well, this is sufficiently extraordinary, I think, to merit an attempt at writing a novel. So my novel is a fictionalised account of the production of Romeo and Juliet in Dartmoor Prison in 1814. So I think that's quite ambitious.
So King Dick is real, because he is the sort of one of the axes of the book, one of the pivots of the book, really. And what makes him so charismatic as a character is, a lot of the time, the rhetoric that you put into his mouth, his words, his speeches. Where did they come from?
Well, it was a real act of concentration over a sustained period, because writing this book, I was obviously very aware that I'm a white Londoner, and I'm trying to put words into the mouth of an African-American in 1814. We know nothing about him until he arrived in Dartmoor, aged about 25, 26. So we don't know anything until this point. I think he's a naturally powerful man. I think he probably was a free man. So he has a natural sense of authority. He takes over Block 4 very, very quickly. So I tried to construct a way of speaking. He clearly loved Shakespeare. So he's a gangster and he loves Shakespeare. What's going on there? You know, this is a revolutionary age. The American and French revolutions are very vivid in everyone's imagination. They only happened a couple of decades ago. The Haitian Revolution as well would have been very to the forefront of his imagination, the only successful slave rebellion in history. So I made him quite a learned man, really, a revolutionary. He talks about Hobbes and Rousseau, you know, because he loves Shakespeare. I mean, he's convinced that Shakespeare was black. He says that very forcefully. So trying to construct words for him was a challenge, but hopefully when people read about King Dick, he emerges as an extraordinary, true figure who has been sort of underreported, I think.
And you mentioned being a white Londoner, writing in the present day about black Americans from the 19th century. You're writing about racism and homosexuality. How difficult was it to write about those issues, putting yourself in the 19th century with a current-day sensibility?
Yeah, well, I kind of went where the story took me, and because Romeo and Juliet is so central to this story, the construction of the book is based around Romeo and Juliet. So Romeo and Juliet is told over five acts and takes place over 4.5 days. My book takes place over 4.5 months, but I've also written it in five acts. The race side of the story certainly came to the surface far more than I thought it was going to when I started. Charlottesville happened halfway through the writing of the book. And it's true that in the memoirs of the white sailors who survived and went home and wrote their stories and they became bestsellers, they don't talk about race tension really in their memoirs, but then that may well be because they were the whites and it was the white sailors who had asked for the segregation. And I think the act of segregation, of putting the non-whites in Block 4, was an act of violence. And so I think if you'd had a conversation with the black sailors, they would come up with a very different interpretation of what it was like in Prison 4. And also, the whole structure of Romeo and Juliet is two houses. There is no evidence for this, but if you were going to put on Romeo and Juliet in 1814 and you're in a black block and next door is a white block, I think you might think, OK, well, we'll be Capulets, you be Montague. I don't know, how do you want to run that? So it kind of lent itself naturally to the story. Whether it's got a modern sensibility, I think all the best historical fiction feels contemporary. I did an event last week with Robert Harris, who's the master of all this, of course, and when he writes about Cicero, you still feel as though he's writing about modern politics and spin doctors and so on. So I felt that it was a contemporary novel, even though it was set a couple of hundred years ago.
Now, how did it feel using words in the book that we wouldn't use now, that aren't very nice?
Yeah, I mean, I write about it in the author's note at the end about the language. I think I was led by... So Stephen King talks about honest dialogue. He wrote a book called On Writing, and he talks about how he writes and so on. And he talks about honest dialogue, that if people don't believe the way your characters speak, you might as well give up. I think I've written in a way in which sailors in 1813, 1814 would have spoken. You know, this is after the Revolutionary War, but it's before the American Civil War. The slave trade had been abolished in 1807 in this country, but obviously very much active and divisive and destructive in the United States of America. So I think my white sailors speak the way you would imagine that they would have spoken back then, and it's pretty shocking. I think I probably toned it down a little for the modern reader, but yes, I did feel as though I just needed to say, look, these words are offensive and powerful, but I think it's honest dialogue.
And you mentioned Romeo and Juliet there. It sounds like you got to know Romeo and Juliet pretty well.
Yeah, I did. Yes, I did. And what an extraordinary play it is. I mean, I don't know how much to assume. My guess is that most people know that Romeo and Juliet was one of the great love stories and that it ends badly. They're the only things that I've assumed. However, the more you know about Romeo and Juliet, the more you will notice throughout the book various characters represent other characters in Romeo and Juliet. So I've got a Tybalt and I've got a Mercutio and there's a Benvolio and there's a Romeo and Juliet in there, obviously. And some of the lines and dialogue from Romeo and Juliet find themselves into the book, because you can do that because it's free, because you don't have to pay Shakespeare copyright anymore. So it's sort of infused all the way through with Romeo and Juliet. Yeah.
A lot of celebrities now, or several celebrities, are writing novels. The public is sometimes a little sceptical about these novels. It's clearly you've written this, it's clearly your voice in there, but that must be quite frustrating.
Well, it happened more just when I started the first Itch book, which is a few years ago now, that there were general inquiries, you know, who did I write it with? But having written those three and then written Blame a few years ago, I think I've got over... people may well be cynical, but trust me, most of us do it on our own, and this is entirely my own. Now, I think after the first book, people realised that it was something that I wanted to do. And I went around schools for 2 years, you know, visiting two or three schools a week, talking about writing and telling stories. So it's very much part of what I do, I think, now.
And Mad Blood Stirring by Simon Mayo is published by Doubleday. Our studio guest on Bookmark today is Peter Adamson. Peter, Simon talking there about the research he did for his book. How much research did you have to do for your novel? It's set in the 1980s, so very much within... living, to me, recent memory, but I guess, you know, it's 30, 40 years ago.
One thing that surprised me that I had to research was New York in the 1980s, I thought I would remember it much better than I actually did. But thanks to Google Street View, and I was able to make good many of the gaps in the memory. I also, more importantly, did quite a lot of scientific research on it. Fortunately, I have a lot of good contacts and friends and colleagues who could make that a lot easier than it might have been otherwise. So yes, and I think a novel, I think, depends heavily on finding the right realistic salient detail, not over-describing everything, but having a vivid detail coming up frequently wherever you are, which is one of the main tools for making it convincing and vivid. And so lots of small things like that, I think, need careful research. Otherwise, if you just think everything up out of the imagination, I mean, that's where most of a novel comes from. But if you invent too many details and never take in any outside input and research into the novel, it can become very bland and predictable, and kind of people know you're inventing it. You need the surprising detail where you hope people don't think about it, they're just convinced by it. But if they did, you hope that they think, well, no one would think of that. It makes it real because it doesn't sound or look made up.
And I think perhaps particularly in your novel, we needed to feel convinced and that it was authentic because of the step the four central characters take on this conspiracy. We needed to feel that it was a real world.
That's exactly right. And that was the by far the biggest problem in writing the novel, was to get over, or rather make convincing to a reader, the idea that five reasonable, intelligent, normal people would do something that's far from normal, that is entering onto a dramatic conspiracy. And that's a problem, because if I had rushed that, there's no way it would have been convincing. There's no way that these five would have rushed into a thing like this. It had to be something that came about gradually and carefully. And some people would think, some people call that slow, and some people like the slow burn. But it certainly would have been unconvincing if I had tried to rush the development of the plot. Because I do think that it's important that almost anybody reading it, even when they're into the more extraordinary aspects of it, would still be with the characters and still be thinking, I can see why they're where they're at.
Oh, yes, certainly. No, it's certainly credible. Well, let's hear your second choice of music now, which is Leonard Cohen and Steer Your Way. Why this one?
This is came out during the time that I was researching and writing the novel. Leonard Cohen's a big favourite. I always loved this one when it first came out. It's a take, as many listeners will recognise, on the Wardlow poem, the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Mark Twain did a take on this too, in which he uses the line, the original line is, for he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. Twain's version is, he died to make men holy, let us die to make men rich. So, and Leonard Cohen's, even more satirical, is, he died to make men holy, let us die to make men make things cheap.
Steer your heart past the truth that you believed in yesterday, such as fundamental goodness and the wisdom of the way.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest today, Peter Adamson, talking about his novel, The Kennedy Moment. And you're going to read an extract for us now, Peter.
Yes. I'll take the extract from the end of the book rather than the beginning. There is one character who misses both of the reunions. Tom Keeley is the character, and he writes the postscript and tells the story of how he, in the end, pieced together the story of what really happened at the reunions that he missed out on. And the extract goes like this. He's talking, I should say, with one of the characters who was part of the conspiracy, Toby Jeggs. He sat back in the booth and looked at me in a roomy-eyed, wistful way. mumbling something whimsical about reaching a point in life when you realise that the meat and potatoes are in the past and most of the puddings are off the menu. And I wish, Tom, you'd been at that reunion in Oxford all those years ago, because then I could tell you what really happened. Well, it must have been some kind of deal if it still has to be a secret after all this time. It was some kind of deal. It was, Tom. Truth is, I only ever really did one do-goody thing in my life, I mean. But here's the thing. It probably did more good than all the other do-gooders in the world rolled into one big fat do-gooder, if you see what I mean. Toby staggered off to the washroom, and it was there, sitting on a bar stool in Charlie O's, with Manhattan's happy hour getting underway around me, that the pieces first began to drift towards each other. Something had happened at those reunions. Something important enough for Toby Jenks to be clinging to it like a moral life raft more than 30 years later. Something that still had to be kept secret, even after all this time.
Yes, it's told from, well, from four points of view, but you have a fifth point of view sort of coming in and out every now and again. How did you write that, Peter? Did you write it each person's point of view and then slot it all together, or did you move in and out of characters?
No, I moved in and out of characters because there is an authorial voice as well, and I tried to... I'm sure lots of listeners are familiar with books which have multiple characters at different points of view, and it's very hard if you get into one character and you're enjoying the situation and their voice, and then a new chapter begins, and sometimes there's a feeling, oh, I wanted to stay with that character, and you're going to one that you like less well. I was really trying to avoid that. Don't think I entirely succeeded. Don't think you ever do, but I really wanted to not have any kind of sinking feeling when you move from one character to the other. I wanted them all to be equally involving, so I kept it all in one narrative.
And these five, they are all quite different. So there's something, were you conscious of having something for every reader to relate to?
Yes, they're very different in character as well as in their nationality and backgrounds. I hope that they speak in different ways. You know, again, this is probably unachievable, but ideally, the ideal you would aim at as a writer is that the reader would know who is speaking just by the way in which they speak, rather than having to do a kind of clumsy said so-and-so, he said this or whatever all of the time. That, of course, is too much of an ideal, but I do think it's worth working on the different voices. A little bit easier in this case because they have different nationalities. I felt very, very sorry for Adam Sims, who narrated this book for Audible.com as an audiobook, because he had to handle these different characters. And it wasn't only that one was Australian and one was a Pakistani and one Brit and one, two Americans, a Canadian. He had to differentiate between a Canadian and American accent. He had to remember that Toby Jenks, the Australian, has been in London for 20 years and has more or less lost the Australian accent, but tends to lean on it much harder when he's being sarcastic. So there are lots of language complications in their accents, which I must say Adam Sims did an absolutely wonderful job with.
And some of the characters more likeable than others. Did you have a favourite?
My favourite, strangely, a strange thing happened with the characters. All the characters except one are involved in what might be called doing good work of one kind or another, whether it's the World Health Organization or whether it's, you know, being a medic in West Africa. The one who isn't is the Australian Toby Jenks, who works as an accounting, as a creative director of a large advertising agency in London. And even he feels that he's wasting his life in the kind of things that he's doing. He's everybody's favourite character who reads the book. Quite what this is telling us, I'm not sure. My favourite characters,
the appeal of the bad boy, maybe.
I think my favourite characters were a minor character of Camden Hughes, who is an African American senior official of the United Nations, independently wealthy, lawyer, high flying career again, desperate to get the time to work on a biography he's trying to write of Marcus Garvey, but everything keeps getting in his way. He's a minor character, but don't know, he somehow appealed to me, and I enjoyed writing every scene in which he features.
Well, thank you, Peter. Well, let's go now to writers at the start of their career. The annual Rock Road Library Writing Competition is open to children and young people aged between 7 and 16 years old. The theme this year was Home as Inspiration, with entrants invited to write poetry and short stories on the theme of home. We'll hear two winning entries now. We'll start with Cabbages and Sweets by Amelie Bentham, a winner in the 7 to 11-year-old category, followed by Home by Miriam Wassell, a winner in the 12 to 16-year-old category. The readers are Izzy Rees and James Stedman.
When I think of home, I think of the grass made of sweet sugar, crunching under my feet as I walk. I imagine flowers with luminous, different colours of the rainbow made out of chewy Haribos. The trees are grown with mouth-watering chocolate and a bush of candy floss on top. But my absolute favourite is the chocolate lake. The chocolate lake falls out of a cave high up at the top of Biscuit Mountain. It cascades down a beautiful chocolate fall of delight. Now, I've only told you half of it. What else is there that you can never get rid of, even in your dreams? Parents. The other side of the island is not as pleasant. No, this side has a forest of cabbage. You have to brush your teeth every morning and evening. You have to do all the house chores and go to bed at 7 o'clock. Well, that's the time a baby goes to sleep. And that's only half of it. The grass has to be neatly mowed every day, and the main meal consists of either cabbage soup, cabbage pie, cabbage bread, cabbage mix, which is mouldy cabbage, fresh cabbage, and cabbage that's been picked too early. And sometimes, if you are lucky, you might get some spinach. So the main point I want to make is, well, I think you stay on the sweet side. That's my advice.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Whistling kettles, the smell of frying bacon, padding footsteps and a toaster popping, your mouth already dribbling at the thought. Blinds opening, dogs barking and the insistent squawks of birds. You can feel the sun coming in through the window, shining on your closed eyelids, cosy, warm and comforting. You feel a harsh dash of cold air on the tip of your nose. You turn over, squishing your face into the hard-as-rock pillow. You realise how loud everything is. Whirring alarm clocks ringing through your ears, footsteps pacing and pacing so loud they can't be much more than an inch away. You feel a constant jab all over your body. Trying to wiggle your legs apart, they move as one, struggling to get away from each other. Thrashing your arms and legs wildly, trying to escape the constriction, you open your eyes. A tear rolls down your cheek as you look around. You can't see pillows and your duvet on your mothballed carpet. You don't hear whistling kettles or smell frying bacon. You see only the bleakness of the street in front of you. You feel the drops of rain all over your body and cold, damp air around you. Smelling only cigarette smoke and smog, you unzip your sleeping bag and unwillingly get out. As you start to roll up your tattered sleeping bag, you let your mind wander back to what life used to be. As you put your shoes on, you remember having family and safety and security. As you shove your sleeping bag away, you remember being happy, not having to worry about tomorrow, being able to feel warmth and love. And most of all, you remember the feeling of being at home. You sit on your stuff, sleeping bag, battered toothbrush, and a small heap of pennies in a ripped bin bag. You walk to the public toilets, gingerly placing your bag by your side as you splash your face with the metallic-smelling water. When you finally find your toothbrush, the bristles are threadbare and bent in all directions. carefully you run it under the flowing water and wipe it around your mouth as you have no toothpaste. As you spit out the water, you catch a glimpse of blood. You walk out, feeling the bright morning sun in your eyes. You walk past cafes, smelling sausages, bacon and freshly buttered toast. The lion in your stomach is roaring and snarling. After walking through the wet, dank streets, you sit on a bench, feeling the damp soak into your clothes. Rummaging through your bag, you find money, 94p. You cross the deserted street and head into the packed corner shop. As you push open the door, a bell rings, and you feel two pairs of cold eyes looking at you. You give them a polite smile and walk around the shop. You can feel their eyes on your back and hear whispers as one of them comes up behind you, supposedly to stack something. As you grab a banana, the person is so close, you can feel their breath on the back of your neck. You place the banana on the counter and shamefully count out the pennies. You give them the right amount, and they give you a death glare as they check. You just will yourself to disappear into the ground. The shopkeeper pokes you with the banana, and the other holds the door open for you. As you leave, tears stream down your face like a waterfall. You scowl. This is not going to get the better of you. You eat your banana and let your mind drift back to home. The comforting hugs from your family. The living room with the blazing fire, blankets and pillows scattered on the fluffy carpet. The kitchen, the warmth of the oven, the always overflowing fruit bowl, the photos and magnets cluttering the fridge. Your room covered in clothes and things you just couldn't bear to throw away. You would give anything to be there now. You sit in your usual spot, a raised concrete area outside the main train station, your head facing your feet. More and more people come and go, not one of them giving you a second glance. It's like you're invisible, or people don't want you to exist. Your brow creases and your chin wobbles. "Excuse me," says a passerby. You flinch, but look up inquiringly. He smiles. Not in a mocking or pitying way, but in a way that makes you feel like he cares. "I'm going to get a coffee. Would you like one?" "Please, please," you reply. He walks across the road into the shop. Stunned, you sit there and think. It's like he cares, like he understands. It's like he wants the best for you. He comes back, cup in hand, and for the first time in what seems like forever, you smile. Not a polite smile, but genuine. As he walks away, you watch. You have hope. A gift greater than no other. Without knowing it, that one passerby has, by a single act of kindness, given you a chance to be in the one place you long for. Home.
And we heard Cabbages and Sweets by Amelie Bentham, read by Izzy Rees, and Home by Miriam Wessel, read by James Steadman. Amelie and Miriam, both winners in the annual Rock Road Library Writing Competition. Well, we're coming to the end of our time with you on Bookmark, I'm afraid, Peter Adamson. We've been talking about your novel, The Kennedy Moment, published by Myriad Editions. What next for you?
Oh, almost finished a new novel.
Yes.
Something completely different.
Something completely different.
But first, I should say about your writing competition, I wish I had written Chocolate Fall of Delight.
It was wonderful, wasn't it? Yes. I think some people might steal that one, yes. And a question that we ask all our guests here on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
I've just finished another Myriad book, Umi Sinha's Belonging, which is a wonderful book of a multi-generational family saga, but it's a lot more than that. And I'm about to start, I believe you've had her on the programme, Ruth Fingers' book, Magnetism.
She was our previous guest.
Got that and have that to look forward to. In between, I've been reading James Scudamore's Heliopolis, set in in Buenos Aires has something in common with my first book in that it's about the contrast of rich and poverty in a big third world city.
So lots to keep you busy.
Yeah, busy enough.
Well, lovely to have you on Bookmark today. Thank you very much for coming along. Just a heads up, our next show, our studio guest will be Sarah Marshall Ball talking about her novel Hush. We'll also hear from Andrew Copson. He's chief executive of Humanists UK. He's written a book on secularism. And we'll hear more of those wonderful winning entries from the Rock Road Library Writing Competition. But we will sign out now with your last choice of music, Peter. It's Joan Byers, and to Bobby, why this one?
This song actually features in the book at the very end when the group get together again. This is the song that's playing in the background.
And I will sing to you so sweet and hope my words will carry home to your heart. You left us marching on the road and said how heavy was the load. But the years were young, the struggle